se și te nepoțe, coțe biștine. Nu spigule și cora, nu spigule și cora, coțe și te nepoțe, coțe biștine. Nu spigule și cora, se nu mancea nu le timbine.
Hello, and joining you not yet in Italy, but poised to travel to the city of Fiat, La Mole Antonelliana, Grissini, that's breadsticks, Juventus, Lavazza, Martini, Gianni Savio, Carla Bruni, Zabaione, Sandro Mazzola, Cafe Vergnano, the last king of Italy, the world's first one-day classic bike race. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm, of course, referring to the fact that I'll soon be heading to Turin on Saturday, that is Saturday the 4th of May, the Giro d'Italia starts there, although I should really say that the Giro starts here with the cycling podcast Giro Vagando XL race preview, ready to reunite with me in Turin on Friday is the former CSC Team Sky and Green Edge press chief, Leopard Trek team manager, the great Dana attack dog, the Baron or Il Barone, Brian Nygaard. Brian, are you ready?
I'm very ready. I think this is the most excited I've been going to the Giro in a very long time. You know, it's almost become, and I'm not taking this for granted, it's become a tradition doing the Giro with you. And that's obviously a thing I look forward to very much.
You look quite excited. You don't sound that excited, but you know, this is just the sort of the Nordic cool come into play, you know. Sounding very sort of Scandinavian matter of
exactly. It's my strange version of the hygge.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now, most of you listeners, of course, won't be coming with us on our journey. At least I hope not, because there won't be room in the car. But taking you to Italy through the medium of Eurosport's live broadcast will be l'egregio signor Rob Hatch.
Buongiorno. Rob Hatch.
Sounding a bit coldy. Not sounding that excited. Come on, Rob.
I'm trying to get it out the way before I end up talking you all to death in the next 3 weeks. I am dressed in pink, though, so that will help. That shows a little bit of excitement, surely, doesn't it? Come on.
Yes, I was. I've got an event tonight, chaps. We've got an event, Kilometre Zero Live, our inaugural Kilometre Zero Live, where we'll be talking about the Giro d'Italia virtually for Friends of the Podcast with Larry Warbass and Joe Dombrowski, and I was thinking about novelty attire. We were doing our sort of screen test yesterday, and I happened to be wearing a polo neck, which I quite frequently do, as you know, Rob. And Larry was asking me whether it was a sort of de rigueur uniform for tonight. Everyone had to wear a polo neck. It's not. However, I was thinking of what Giro-themed attire I could wear. I haven't really come up with anything yet, although I do have this next to me at the moment. Don't ask me why. Got a Saunier
wow.
Develt 2006 replica, not a replica, the genuine article. Sort of
Is it signed by anyone?
Did you pick that up in a prison cell?
I've got some absolute crackers from that era. But that is a lovely jersey. Saunier Deval 2000.
Can I just say though, Daniel, your current the t-shirt you're currently wearing is actually the color of a very mature Nebbiolo.
Ah, it is actually. That's true. Granata, it's perfect. It's for, and this is a tribute to Torino, the Torino Football Club, subject of a Kilometre Zero coming out today, in fact, Grande Torino. Maybe more about that later, chaps. But we got a hell of a lot to get through discussing all things Giro d'Italia. However, tradition dictates that we start the podcast with a news roundup. Now, boys, last week we didn't put out a regular episode, so in theory we have a fortnight of news headlines to recap. However, in the interest of brevity and pertinence to the matter at hand today, I'm going to basically gloss over a lot of stuff and just tell you what's gone on over the last few days. I'll start with the racing again, only focusing on the last week. I'll also begin with a grand tour that has already started, never mind the one we're going to be focusing on later in the episode. Yes, because La Vuelta a España Femenina rolled out from Valencia on Sunday with a 16-kilometre team time trial that was won by Little Trek with Gaia Realini, she is Italian, crossing the line in first place, therefore taking the Maillot Rojo, the red jersey. The race will finish next weekend in Madrid. Staying in Spain, the Vuelta a Asturias was most notable not for the presence of Rob Hatch in Gijón over the weekend, not far away, but some eye-catching performances by UAE Team Emirates baby phenoms Antonio Morgado and Isaac del Toro, both age 20, respectively. They won the final stage and the general classification. Del Toro's results in the three stages were first, third, and second. Meanwhile, the positively ancient Finn Fisher Black, age 22, completed a UAE clean sweep by winning the last stage on the final day. Another stage race dominated by one team was the Tour of Turkey. Seven stages there. Should have been eight, but the last day was cancelled due to inclement weather. Rain?
Yeah, was it? It was raining. There was a lot of rain in the end. Really, really dangerous on those cobbles in Istanbul, those old streets. So yeah, they decided to neutralise it.
I said it was dominated by one team. Five of those seven stages were won by DSM Firmenich Post NL riders. That team also claimed the overall title thanks to Frank Vandenbroek. Well, that is a 90s or a noughties revival, but it's a different Frank Vandenbroek. Good ride there for Mahawi Kudus in the colours of the Terengganu, Rob?
Terengganu, yep. One of the biggest teams, I think I always say this, but they're one of the biggest, most historic teams on the Asia Tour. They've been around a long time.
You always say that. He was second overall. He was second overall. The other big stage race taking place last week was of the World Tour variety, the Tour de Romandie in Switzerland. The overall title there went to Sugarman Carlos Rodriguez, who edged out the Bora Hansgrohe dynamic duo, Alexander Vlasov and Florian Lipovits, by 7 and 9 seconds, respectively. The stage wins there had gone to Michael Zeilert, Dorian Godon, Thibaut Nace, Brandon McNulty, Richard Carapaz, and Godon again. Rodriguez's victory was his first GC in a stage race, I believe.
It was.
A couple of... I'm going to leave the racing there, chaps. They were the main races that happened over the last week. A bit of a sort of hiatus before the Giro.
Hasn't he won the Tour of Britain?
No, he won the final stage.
Carlos Rodriguez.
No, something else as well. Do you know what? It was the first Ineos Grenadiers World Tour GC for almost 2 years.
Seriously?
20 months since the Tour of Poland, 2022.
They've had a much better April than March and February.
They've been brilliant. I mean, you know, we were saying where are the victories a couple of weeks ago. We have to then give them their dues. They've been fantastic the last couple of weeks, haven't they? It sounds like, looks like things might be starting to come together.
Yeah. A couple of important contract renewals that I thought we should mention. One regards a team, that team being Cofidis. And last week, they were celebrating the news that their sponsor has renewed its commitment to the team until 2028, meaning that they will reach and pass the landmark of 30 years in the pro peloton. What a story. What commitment. Very stoical bunch, Cofidis. Speaking of long-term deals on the rider front, I mentioned Isaac Del Toro. The Mexican is now the World Tour rider with the lengthiest contract, having added a further 3 years to his existing deal with UAE Team Emirates. He will now be tied to the team until at least 2029. I mean, that's like the future, isn't it, chaps? That's like, I think people will have hoverboards in 2029. I think people will be time traveling.
They're already doing
that. Tadej Pogacar, I should remind people, the team's kingpin, apex predator, talisman. He has a contract with the team until 2027, the end of 2027. Lots of very long contracts for riders at UAE. Two of the riders staying put next year are Bora Hansgrohe pair Jai Hindley and Florian Lipovits, who I already mentioned, the revelation of the Tour de Romandie. They've both extended their existing deals, albeit that the team didn't say exactly until when new agreements are valid. That is a sort of practice that we see in football, long-term contracts being signed but not necessarily communicated, the length of them not necessarily being communicated. I doubt, particularly in Hindley's case, I doubt it's only 1 year. His deal was due to expire, I think, at the end of this year. But he is now tied to the team until at least the end of 2025. Final contract I'll mention is not between a rider and a team, but a rider and a sportswear company. Demi Vollering confirmed on her social media channels last week that she has become a Nike athlete. Chaps, I thought it was quite significant as a measure of sort of how far women's cycling has come in the last couple of years, not least because Nike all but sort of completely pulled out of cycling some time ago, only retained a tiny number of slightly nebulous endorsement deals whereby riders, your mate, our mate, Adam Blythe, for example, yep. Rob, sported the Nike swoosh on products that were never commercialized. Cavendish is another one. He has always worn Nike shoes. But a big deal that is. I did some reading around online. There has been some talk in the kind of sneaker world. You know, there's this whole sort of corner of the internet. What do they call? What sneaker heads, is it? Sneaker freaks? People who are very interested in trainers. There are articles online.
Every day's a school day with you, Daniel. I had no idea about this.
There are articles online.
I just thought you went
Nike.
Down to shop and bought some.
Yeah. Nike's history with other sports, with its history with cycling. There has been talk of them getting back into cycling, having pulled out. I think they pulled out completely in about, did I read, around about 2012? Apart from those couple of...
Wasn't it in connection with Lance?
Yeah, they used to do shoes. They used to actually make shoes, or at least claim to make shoes. I think most of their stuff was made by Giordano, the Italian clothing company. But they used to have a shoe...
DMT made.
Was it? I thought it was DMT, but then I read yesterday Giordano. They used to do a shoe called the Poggio, which was a bit of a strange choice of shoe, of name. This was in the Armstrong era because Armstrong never really did anything in Milan-San Remo. It was a bit of a training ride for him. And Nike, to be honest, chaps, not a company I've got that much time for. Partly for reasons... Well, I would recommend anyone who's interested... listen to Cara Goucher. She's a former distance runner. Her podcast with Rich Roll recently. That was a month or two ago where she sort of, well, reveals the dark underbelly of Nike, certainly a few years ago anyway. That said, I would also recommend Phil Knight's biography, memoir, Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, book called Shoe Dog, which is absolutely cracking read. Rob, you wear a lot of Nike. I don't think you're sponsored by them, but you sport a lot of Nike sneakers.
It looks all right, doesn't it? But yeah, I probably wouldn't want to dive too deep into the underbelly because I don't think it's a great industry, is it? Fast fashion, let's put it that way.
No, it's not. Chaps, after the break, we're going to Italy, at least figuratively, for now.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by AG1. I've made AG1 a part of my morning routine over the past couple of months. Pretty much the first thing I do in the morning is I put a scoop of AG1 powder into my water bottle. I fill it up with water, give it a good shake until it's well blended, and then I drink it. And it's replaced my old routine, which was to have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea to start my day. And I feel like AG1 is getting me off to a more beneficial start, because although I love a cup of coffee in the morning, as you'll know, I like a cappuccino anytime after 11, I feel like it's a bit of a jump leads type start to the day. And AG1 is getting me off to a better start, not least because I'm rehydrating straight away with a glass of water. And then the important bit, the AG1 is giving me a blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other goodies that I might not be able to get from eating even the most perfectly balanced diet. So I feel like I'm giving my body and mind exactly what it needs before I get my day off to a start. Don't just take my word for it. AG1 is trusted by Olympic athletes and sports people. And as a result, it is tested to make sure that there are no contaminants in it. Did you know, though, that AG1, which was created 14 years ago, has been improved 52 times over the years? So AG1 is not standing still. They've been refining and improving the recipe, making sure they've got the best possible supplements included in the blend. And, well, the results are that I've made it my daily routine over the past couple of months. AG1 are so confident that you'll like it that if you're not satisfied 100%, you can contact them within 90 days of your first order and they will give you your money back. So if you want to replace your multivitamins, start with AG1. Try AG1 now and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs, which are ideal if you're going away, perhaps on a cycling trip somewhere, and you want to take some with you. Go to drinkag1.com/cycling. That's drinkag1.com/cycling.
So, Herbie, we've arrived. Small ceremony taking place here. We've just heard Faustino Coppi, Fausto's son, speak. But just describe to me where we're standing and what we can see right in front of us.
Okay, so we're on Corso Casale, which is kind of a thoroughfare, the boulevard that runs alongside the River Po. And in front of us we have the monumental Fausto Coppi. In the early 93 or 94, a group of Piemontese cycling fans, cycling people, headed by Nino De Filippis, who was a very famous Italian champion of the 50s, decided to fund a Fausto Coppi monument in Torino, which obviously is the capital city of Coppi's Piemonte. So we're now stood before that, and there's a ceremony taking place to honour Fausto. The monument is 100 metres or so from the velodrome, the famous Turin velodrome, and 100 metres the other way is where Fausto's brother Serse crashed in Milano Torino. So if we look towards Pino Torinese, towards the hill, the big hill above Turin, with where Superga, if people that know Turin would...
Scene of another famous crash in cycling Marco Pantani crashed in 1995, Milano Torino.
95. Fausto's brother Serse came off, he caught his front wheel, I think, in a tram line at the 1951 Milano Torino, crashed, banged his head, went back to the hotel, started to complain of a headache, and some hours later died here in Turin in hospital. So Corso Casale is very significant in Italian cycling history context for that reason as well. Fausto also famously crashed in the velodrome, and another edition broke his collarbone, and another edition of Milan Turin, which subsequently compromised his Giro d'Italia. So Coppi had a lot of bad luck in Turin, but you know, Turin is one of Italian cycling, or was one of Italian cycling's heartlands.
And behind us, we've got two huge rocks with kind of plaques on them.
Yeah.
And one's the Puy de Dôme, the other one is the Col de la Croix de Fer. So two famous Tour de France mountains. Are they real chunks of mountains?
Yeah, and we also have Issoire, we have Galibier, we have a piece of the Stelvio. And on the monument itself, we have photos of Fausto under glass from many of his great exploits. So there'll be something from the Issoire, there'll be something from Stelvio, Galibier. The place recalls his great exploits. This was the great... I mean, there is the Italians always say that perhaps Merckx was the best cyclist that ever lived, but Coppi was irrefutably the greatest, and I think there's some truth in that.
Well, chaps, that was a little postcard from the annals from the last time the Giro d'Italia started in Turin in 2021. It's a city that has a long association, long and kind of glorious association, not just with the Giro d'Italia, but cycling in general. Brian, you looking forward to getting our boots on the ground in Turin? Like Turin?
Very much so. I like Turin a lot. I think I visited the first time there were, I think, in the Giro of maybe 5 or 6. There was a time trial there. I think it went over the Superga, actually. Yeah, and it's a city that you often kind of forget when you talk about Italy, especially as a foreigner. You know, you have Milano, Venezia, Florence, Rome, obviously, and Torino somehow gets a little bit forgotten in that, going through the big names of the great cities. But it's a wonderful city, isn't it? And it also, you know, not just because of the tradition for cycling, but also culinary, it's a fantastic city, and obviously in the region of Piemonte. So what's not to like?
Yeah, I have to admit, it was the first ever contact I had with Italy when I landed there and went on a holiday as a kid. And just like Brian, I'm really glad you said that, because it is a place that gets forgotten. And I'm guilty of that, even though it's the first place I ever touched down in the country. But, you know, like you said, fantastically beautiful city. We don't think we ever give it enough recognition for that, do we? Because we think of other things. I certainly always think of the football. I always think of the Alps in the background, but I forget all the Baroque buildings and things like that. And it's also special for me because it's where I first did a bit of sports journalism, really. When I first started working at Eurosport, I went to interview a couple of Juventini there, the then manager Claudio Ranieri and Gigi Buffon as
tinker,
well. They were the first
tinker.
Sort of interviews I did.
I didn't know, you were a fan. You were fond of the Tinker Man, but I didn't know you'd interviewed him.
No, fantastic. What a lovely man as well. What an absolutely... gave so much time. We went all the way out to the training ground, and I lived in Florence, so I'm anything but a Juventino. They're sort of an anti-football team to me, but I really admire the love that they have. And of course, as you'll talk about, Torino itself, I think when I was there, I went to the Comunale and saw a match because Juventus were playing there at the time when the old stadium was being redone. But anyway, enough football, but it is a wonderful, wonderful
place. Not quite enough football, Rob, because I should. Well, that's the perfect excuse to tell the listeners that we have got Kilometre Zero coming out today. The first of three Giro Vagando Kilometre Zeros coming out this week to whet your appetites for the Giro d'Italia. And it is mainly about Torino, but Torino, the city, and Torino, the football club. Don't cover your ears now if you don't like football, because this is a story that goes way beyond football. It is the tale of Grande Torino, maybe Italy's greatest ever football team, who perished, who died in an air disaster, in a plane crash in 1949. It is the 75th anniversary on Saturday of that plane crash, and almost to the minute, an hour, and the race is going past the site of that crash, the Superga Basilica, which is important in Italian history for all sorts of other reasons, which you will discover if you listen to that podcast, and more maybe about the other Giro Vagando Kilometre Zero is coming out this week later on. Chaps, we are heading to Italy, Il Bel Paese. Italy, I mean, we're going to talk a lot about Pogacar later, but Italy, as ever, will be the real start of the Giro d'Italia. What kind of year has it been for Italy so far, chaps? Brian, 2024 has been the year of Pandoro Gate. Afraid to say, possibly the biggest story of the year so far. Brian, do you want to enlighten the listeners as to what, quickly, briefly, as to what Pandoro Gate has been, is, or who are the protagonists?
Or as I like to call it, the death of a saleswoman. So the biggest social media star in Italy is Chiara Ferragni, which she has, I haven't checked lately, she probably lost a few, but probably 20, 30, if not 40 million
followers.
Well, she bought
a few, apparently, allegedly.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it was worth it. But she... she's come into quite of the stormy weather because of a couple of campaigns that related to charity. And it was it's called Pandora Gate because she used her platform to promote a Pandora, which is it's a cake, isn't it? And it's something that you would buy for...
It's just panettone without the raisins. It's similar to panettone,
yeah, the kind of
without
panettone
the raisins.
I like, anyways. But it turned out that the amount of money that eventuated into the account of the charity organization, which here I think was a children's hospital, was very minuscule and very much a stark contrast to the money that went into her bank account, which was, I think, roughly around €1 million, but around maybe 30,000 euro went to the charity. And it's all gone downhill since then, because they discovered another fraudulent marketing mechanism sort of in the same way. And they've pressed charges against her. It's turned into a real big case. And then it's turned into a social media soap opera for someone who has their own TV show. She, you know, her and her very much in the public eye former partner, Fedez, have left each other. And it's just become a bit of a meltdown in front of everyone's eyes.
Yeah, it's become pretty unsavory. No sort of pun intended. We're talking about sweet foodstuffs, not savory. But yeah, it has been probably the biggest sort of popular, certainly new biggest pot boiler, certainly in Italy so far this year. There's also a cycling link. Balocco, the manufacturer of the Pandoro in question, they sponsored the pink jersey from 2013, 2015. And there's a tragic story about Balocco, actually. The CEO, president of Balocco, Alberto Balocco, was struck by lightning and killed while he was on a mountain bike ride just a couple of years ago. So that has certainly been in the headlines in Italy. What else? We've mentioned already once this year that who won San Remo? Who won San Remo, chaps?
Jasper Philipsen.
The other San Remo. Who won actual San Remo? I can't.
No idea.
Festival of San Remo was won by a song called Boredom. It was won by Angelina Mango. A song called Boredom. And what else has been going on in Italy? Chaps, how many earthquakes, how many seismic events do you think took place in Italy before April, up to the beginning of April?
I would say we're going to be surprised by the number because it's right on a fault line, isn't it? Although they don't get reported, they happen all the time, don't they?
Just give me a number.
Well, I follow them manically, so I would say it's in the thousands.
4,124. And very important, maybe we'll come to this later, very worrying, certainly from my point of view and your point of view, Brian, because some of that seismic activity is taking place around the Bay of Naples, and we'll be spending 2 days there. There's been an eruption. Not yet, but there's been an earthquake in the crater of Vesuvius in the last day or two. Brian, quickly, before we end this slightly sort of tortuous tangent about things not related to cycling, can you tell people what's been happening at a site called the Phlegrean Fields, to give it its English name, over the last few days?
Which actually means the fields of fire in Roman names. I think the story is slowly starting to catch on in the international media because it's actually the potential epicenter of this disaster is actually very close. They pass it right on the stage to Naples in Pozzuoli, and it's an underground volcano that's actually pushed the soil of Pozzuoli some 4 meters in the last 50 years or so. And it's an accident waiting to happen. The last time this volcano erupted, theories say that this is why the Neanderthal were extinct, you know, our predecessors on the Earth. So and they found stones from this eruption all the way to in Greenland. And it could actually mean the end of all of us, because if this volcano bursts, it could cover the atmosphere with dust and create a new ice winter. So it'll be the end of all of us. There's various theories as to how alarming this is, but the most alarming ones are certainly a concern of mine and should be a concern of all of us. Now, there's an evacuation plan that's cost millions and millions of euros in place. But if this all of a sudden happens, and that, you know, just the other day there was a 3.9 earthquake, only 3 kilometers from the surface of the Earth. So let's see what's going to happen. I think there might be even a few tremors when you and I are lodging down there, Daniel.
Yes, Lionel, Brian. An article I shared with you at the weekend, an article that was written in Reuters in 2012 talking about this eventuality, a hidden supervolcano that could kill millions in a catastrophe worse than Mount Vesuvius's eruption in 79 AD. So if Tadej Pogacar's listening, probably look to take the pink jersey before we get to Naples on stage 9. That might be a good idea. Chaps, let's talk.
I think that was his plan anyway.
Yeah, I think it was. Well, let's talk finally, shall we, about the... In fact, no, let's not just yet talk about the route. Let's inform the listeners that, as ever, at the Giro d'Italia, Stacey Snyder will be selling her cups, or has already been getting to work on her cups. They feature the design this year, features Superga, the Basilica, and also the Pantheon in Rome, which we thought would be a good idea. Last year it featured the Colosseum, but the Pantheon, why? Well, Tadej Pogacar will, I suppose, consolidate his position in the Pantheon, so to speak, should he win the Giro d'Italia this year, add that to his palmarès. Stacey's cups will be going on sale during stage 2 this time, So that's on Sunday, May the 5th at 10 a.m. US East Coast time, 3 p.m. UK time, 4 p.m. Central European time. We will put information on social media about how you acquire those cups. I think most people already know. Also look out for, if you're interested, Divine Cellars, our Girovagando wine selection. It's already been released, is for sale. Divine Cellars, all one word, .com. Some other bits for housekeeping that maybe we'll do a bit later. We will get now finally to the roots, the race, the Giro d'Italia. The 107th edition of Giro d'Italia begins on Saturday at the Venaria Reale, one of the former residences of the House of Savoy, just to the north of Turin in the far northeast of Italy. The race will measure 3,400.8 kilometres, of which 71.8 kilometres will be in individual time trials. Where does it go? Well, the first stage is a lumpy one with the climbs of Superga, I've already mentioned that, and Grande Torino, the Colle Maddalena, and the pinnacle known as San Vito, just 3 kilometers from the finish line in Turin, on Corso Casale, in fact, which we heard about from Herbie Sykes, or with Herbie Sykes a few minutes ago. Following day, it's into the mountains, specifically the Sacri Monti, with a summit finish at the Santuario di Europa, which became enshrined in cycling lore thanks to Pac-Man-style Marco Pantani comeback and stage win in 1999. Three probable sprint stages follow in Fossano, Andorra and Lucca as we head towards the Apennines. Then it's on some Tuscan Strade Bianche, 11.6 kilometers of gravel roads to be exact, on stage 6 to Rapolano Terme. Stage 7 takes place in Umbria between Foligno and Perugia. It's 40.6 kilometer time trial with a nasty kick up the behind in the closing kilometers. That's Friday. Saturday sees the second mountaintop finish of the race to Prati di Tivo, scene of a pogcineration in the 2021 Tirreno. Then it's a flattish, quite flat, figuratively speaking, I would say, for a Sunday stage, run towards the southernmost point of this year's race, i.e. Naples and the supervolcano, which hopefully on the rest day, the first rest day, we'll be steering well clear of before the race resumes from Pompeii, which, of course, Lionel and I visited during the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago.
The water fountains were made by 4 blocks of lava, like this one, 1, 2, 3, 4, or by 4 blocks of white marble, like the next estuary. Now, the 4 blocks used to be tied together by iron, soldered in stones by lead. When the fountain was full, also animals were able to...
Where have you brought me now, Daniel?
Well, on last night we stayed in a little bed and breakfast near Eboli, and you had a sauna in your room. I must stress, this is not the kind of establishment, or you don't, that's not on your rider, is it, for the Giro, to have a sauna in your room every night, and you seem to enjoy it. So I thought I'd take you to, well, for full spa treatment this morning.
I didn't go in the sauna, actually, Daniel, there wasn't time, but we're at the Central Baths in the centre of Pompeii. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not exactly fitness first, though, is it? These baths, I mean, not only do they date from, well, I think the construction started around about...
It was AD 62, and it wasn't quite finished when the eruption buried the city.
But, Lionel, this was supposed to be the fitness first, the gym, the big gym, the big sort of showpiece gym of the city of Pompeii. And, well, we've been visiting that city for what remains of that city for the last half an hour or so, and what a treat it has been. What did you expect, Lionel, and how has this lived up to or defied, exceeded your expectations?
I didn't expect it to be as big. I didn't expect it to be as well kind of preserved. I mean, basically, the sort of first story brick and stonework is largely intact.
There are some lovely gravel sections, actually. I mean, in all seriousness, you probably could organise a bit of a... It would be quite technical, wouldn't it? A gravel circuit around here. But I wouldn't put it past the, you know, the hipsters of 2022.
No, I wouldn't either. I mean, Van der Poel, Van Aert, Peter Sagan in his pomp would cope very well with the challenge that the Giro di Pompeii would throw up. But I mean, this is one of the great treats of the Giro Vagando, the chance to come and see this. Absolutely remarkable.
That stage, starting in Pompeii, is a summit finish at the Bocca della Selva, and that could see the last pyrotechnics for a few days as the profiles on week 2 look vaguely piadina-like. Rob, tell people what a piadina is, please.
It's a very nice flat sandwich.
Jesus Christ. Can you not do better than that? come on. I had a little flourish of some description.
I'm saving it all for the next 3 weeks. Sorry.
Okay. It's often described as like a savory.
Gone into semantic hibernation.
Yeah, yeah. It's a sort of savory pancake that gets folded over into kind of, to make a sort of sandwich, kind of halfway between a sandwich and like a calzone, if you know what one of those is. And it is very much associated with that part of the world, the Adriatic coast, where we will be in week two, for a large part of week two. So I said week two looks pretty flat. Though danger could lurk on a Tirreno-style 12th stage to Fano. The second TT of the race measures 31.2 kilometers, finishes on the southern shore of Lake Garda. That's stage 14. Then finally, since the proper mountains, not the tippy-tappy Apennine Antipasti, the Queen Stage, 5,468 meters of climbing, including the softer side of the Mortirolo and the Passo di Foscagno to Livigno. Then an already much maligned stage over the Stelvio on stage 16. The Stelvio at the start of that stage. Bit, I don't know, Brian, like going to El Bulli for cornflakes. El Bulli, the world's most famous.
I'm sure Ferranadria could make something out of it, though.
Yeah, very disappointing. Stage 17 is a proper one in the Dolomites, concluding atop the Passo del Broccon, which then we've got an intermezzo of a sprint stage in Padova, and finally two more days of mountains, the two final days of mountains for any would-be agitators to make their move to Sappada, where we've seen a rebellion before in the Giro, and to Il Grappa, Monte Grappa. And Brian, we've seen you get pretty combative on Grappa before. The final stage, like last year, comes after the frankly unjustifiable decampment of the whole race, all of its people and its vehicles to Rome. And that one, Brian, shall be followed by us from afar, because we will be, well, rebelling against the idea.
Boycotting it, are you?
Boycotting it again, the Rome stage. But we'll of course,
it could be in your Italian spiritual home of Padova.
Yeah, we'll be in Italy. We'll be at an unspecified, maybe secret location in Italy. So, chaps, that is the 107th edition of the Giro d'Italia. Four stages above 200 kilometers. Last year, we carped and moaned and griped a lot about the long stages, lots of long stages. Still got four stages above 200 kilometers. It's got a pretty bad press, this route, generally speaking. Three really hard mountain stages, I would say, Livigno, the Broccon, and the Grappa. But some sort of disappointed, decaffeinated-looking mountain stages. And certainly, Charles, I think what we can say definitively, we can look at the total meters of climbing. It's just over 40,000 meters of climbing. The Giro and RCS have moved away with this route from the idea, this identity of being the hardest of the Grand Tours. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. It's funny, I'll quote Carlos Arribas, a very famous, well-known journalist in El País, who, as soon as the route came out, said, "The Giro betrays its own identity by becoming less mountainous,
Carlos,
taking away the fear and searching for more open racing." Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned just over 40,000 metres of climbing. I've been looking at the Garibaldi that's come out, the first edition to that. They've tinkered with the route a little and they've pushed it up a little. It's more knocking on 44,000, I think, at the minute, if you look at... Yeah, but I mean, that's still 6,000, 7,000 less than the recent edition.
It's also
like that.
It's also doped, Rob, by... I mean, if you look at the individual...
Pardon?
It's doped in the sense that...
can't say that.
Well, it's doped by the Stelvio.
All right,
you're actually right. You're according to VeloView, which is the resource that most of the teams use. Actually, it's 46,000 meters of climbing now, so it has gone up significantly. 46.
Officially, it's 44,650.
Yeah, the RCS.
There's always a discrepancy between the sort of real routes and what they tell you, isn't there?
46,000.
Well, you want to go with VeloView then?
642 meters, and you know, I always look at the individual stages and the amount of climbing in those and. And, you know, you sort of cast your eye over the last week and you see three in a row with a very significant, well, that Queen stage, 5,468 metres. And then the next day, 4,000 metres. However, that is doped by the Stelvio at the start of the stage, and it's not really as intimidating a mountain stage as that statistic leads one to believe. So generally
a lot of time trialing too.
Yeah, 70 kilometers of time trialing. So my conclusion, chaps, is that so many times we've sat here or we've sat before a Giro route and said, this looks like an absolute corker. And the race has not necessarily turned out to be the scintillating spectacle that we've hoped for. So this year, with an absolute turkey of a route, I'm expecting a cracker of a race. I'm expecting an absolute barnstormer of a race.
I think the terrain's there for people who have to attack, isn't it? They have to do something. So from that angle, things have to happen. Otherwise, you're just going to let you-know-who win the race pretty easily. So people have to try and tire Tadej Pogacar out. This is assuming he's on his form and nothing happens. Again, remember, all the usual caveats should apply, shouldn't they? It's a three-week race. We're racing in Italy through small towns. Things can happen. Anything can happen. But there is terrain to do something. But you can't wait for that last week, can you? You cannot wait for those last couple of mountain stages.
I think we also have to look at the dynamics of the race and the what you call it, the internal architecture of the race, because it's a very hard start. It's a very, very hard start, and you'll very early on see who will be able to win. There could even be some GC riders in real trouble very early on. And, you know, it's always the balance. I mean, the official average is 161.9 kilometers. So, and we've been bemoaning the longer stages. You certainly did last year, and I think you were absolutely right, Daniel. But it's more a question of how will the big favorite prioritize to win the bike race. You know, I think he Tadej Pogacar will dictate, I think, how hard this race will be from early on. And I think everything will fall upon his decision making as to how interesting and as to how hard and as to how exciting the various parts of the race will be.
Chaps, we'll talk a lot about Pogacar in the third part of this podcast. But there were, initially, when this shortly after this route was unveiled, there were two riders who were mooted as the kind of showstoppers, well, the bill toppers, and that was Tadej Pogacar and Wout van Aert. Wout van Aert, we didn't necessarily think that he was going to win the race, but we thought that he would have a big impact on the race. I now, thinking about his absence because of that crash in, it was Dwars Door Vlaanderen, wasn't it, Rob?
Yeah.
Yeah. And thinking about his absence, I see it changing things in two important ways. And one, from an entertainment standpoint, you know, we saw a couple of years ago, so in the name of helping Jonas Vingegaard, but Wout van Aert really, he almost dictated the rhythms and the cadence of a Tour de France, which is a harder race to do that in than the Giro d'Italia. So he had the potential almost single-handedly to make a lot of these stages that have, they've become processions, formulaic processions involving a kind of breakaway of the Pro Continental Division teams and then a sprint or a fast finale. He had the capacity on his own to shift that paradigm, change that paradigm. And I think he probably would have done that, A, to try to get the pink jersey, and B, just almost gratuitously, because that's what he does. That's what he likes to do. And sort of secondly, when we think about the economy of Tadej Pogacar's race, I think Wout van Aert, we don't know Jonas Vingegaard's, we don't know how likely he is to take part in the Tour de France, but it's in Jumbo-Visma's interest to tire Tadej Pogacar as much as possible. Wout van Aert would have been the perfect kind of Trojan horse at the Giro d'Italia to ensure that there was something for Pogacar to think about on most days. And I don't see another rider in the field. Rob, maybe in a second you can talk us through the outsiders for the race. But Rob, you say they can't wait until the last week, the last day. You know, just looking at the start list, I just wonder how many of these guys are kind of resigned as they go in and are already thinking that second, third, fourth is a great result. And I don't see them as big sort of agent provocateurs in this race.
No, that's a very good point. And I think we saw that in the classics, didn't we? As soon as Pogacar went in Liège, everybody knew that they were racing for second. And, you know, the advantage ballooned very quickly, didn't it, to a minute. That was that. And they decided to forget about him, essentially, and race each other for the rest of the spots. Romain Bardet won that race. Then there was another race behind for the podium, the final spot on it, which was won by Van der Poel. Here, I'd like to be optimistic and think that people are going to try and race positively. If you do want to do something, why not take your chance? Otherwise, why are you here? If you aren't in it to try and win it, then why are you here? I can see stage wins being the immediate priority of almost every other team, though. And I think in doing that, they will then see what happens rather than having a grand plan to crack Pogacar on, let's say, 14, 15, whichever stage that might be. Pick a number out of a hat. You know, everybody does their reconnaissance missions. We talked a little bit about the Ineos Grenadiers earlier on, didn't we, and how their season was improving. I'm looking at their team, and I think they have a team to actually chase stages and do something different and maybe make the race difficult. You know, you can look at people like Narváez even on the first day. He's been going well this season. A few riders of that ilk will be going away. And in fact, just while we're on that subject of the route and having to move, I think the organisers were desperate for Wout van Aert to be up against Tadej Pogacar on that first day, weren't they, when they added that extra climb to San Vito at the end. Can we see Christophe Laporte, his replacement in the team, doing the same thing? Is he the same rider? I'm not sure. You can certainly see other riders on the start list wanting to have a go there. Biniam Girmay is in town, isn't he? Lawrence Pithy. There's some pretty, pretty exciting riders still there.
Rob, I talked about the...
Bardet, I think needs to be mentioned as well.
Yeah, definitely. Chaps, when we think about the outsiders, the pretenders, the guys who might be waiting in the wings should Pogacar slip up. Rob, can you tell us who they are?
Geraint Thomas is, of course, here, isn't he? He's the main leader at the Ineos Grenadiers. Look out for Ben O'Connor too, Decathlon. They can't stop winning at the minute, can they? Dani Martinez, we think, will lead Bora Hansgrohe. Keep an eye out for the man that you were talking about earlier on, Florian Lipovits. He looks an exciting rider to watch on his Grand Tour debut. Looking around, you can see certain teams just going for stage wins, usually Alpecin de Koenig, things like that. But in terms of general classification, EF Education, Easy Post, they can always surprise us, but they always leave us guessing, don't they? They haven't announced their team yet, and they're always the last team to do that. In fact, as I look down the start list, only one team has announced its final lineup. So usual disclaimers from any names I might read out here if they slip off the list at the end. Looking further down, I know that Nairo Quintana started the season looking at going for GC, but I was chatting to one of their riders who will be in the team the other day, and he said that that's probably not the case now. They're going to actually put an extra man in for Gaviria to do the sprinting, so Quintana will be chasing stages. We think that Alaphilippe might go, but I'm not sure about that. Still yet to be decided. Romain Bardet was the man mentioned by Brian a minute ago, and his team DSM are on fire, aren't they? So keep your eyes out for him. Of course, you look down at Bahrain, they'll have some interesting riders, won't they, in the likes of Tiberi, who's going well. You never quite know what you're going to get from Caruso, but he's not really a big attacker, is he? He's mainly a follower, and he should be there in case of a slip-up rather than that attack. And then looking elsewhere, Keanu Debrooks, is he going to continue to develop? Young pretenders from the likes of Pellizzari is going well in the climbs, but in all seriousness, difficult to see him mounting a three-week challenge on debut. And from Jaco Alula, what are they going to bring us? Dunbar, is there a bit too much time trialing in it for him? Of course, another bit of a stuttered build-up. But there is a Luke Plapp, who was going really well at Paris-Nice. And I think that's more or less that when we look down at the list. But again... Let's wait until the final teams are announced. In fact, you know that we're going to publish this podcast and we'll get a raft of press releases this afternoon.
Just looking at the odds, chaps, who the bookmakers have as the third favourite, I think it will blow your mind.
It's not Pozzo Vivo, is it?
It's Tiberi.
Wow, that is blowing my mind.
The most popular third favourite among the bookmakers. They're sort of split between, well, him and Bardet and O'Connor. Pretty remarkable. And Dani Martinez, he's quite a long way down in terms of the odds, which, based on his pedigree, is quite surprising. And Uta Brooks, a lot of people at the start of the year were anticipating a huge well, salto di qualità, as the Italians say, a huge sort of step up for him when he moved from Visma to Lisabike, but it hasn't really happened yet for him. Maybe it will at the Giro d'Italia. Rob, one area in which this field does look incredibly strong is the sprinters. Who are they?
Hugely. I mean, one of the best sprint lineups for a long, long time. I'm going down in the order of the teams on the list here, and this isn't who I think is the best sprinter first or anything like that, but Caden Groves is going to come back, and he was good last year, good at the Welter, last two Welters, in fact. You look down as well, we're wondering if Ballerini's going to make it. Of course, he'd be a bit of an outside name anyway. You've got David Dekker there. Who else is there? Sam Welsford. For Bora Hansgrohe, you've got some strong riders riding for Decathlon in the general, but Van Dravendraam will be going chasing sprints. Binyam Girmay, he's a huge name to go back.
You've mentioned about six names, and you haven't mentioned any of the. You haven't mentioned a sprinter yet.
Any of the big ones yet? Well, Sam Welsford, come on, that's it. Sam Welsford and Caden Groves are the big ones, aren't they, in that, those first few I've mentioned. Pithy on Grand Tour d'Ebel, I'm really, really excited to see because he showed that he can
climb, but he can sprint. But go on.
Oh, come on. He won sprints at Paris-Nice.
Just say the obvious ones.
Jonathan Milan, who's there as well. You've got Ethan Vernon. Tim Merlier, that's an obvious one for you. The likes of Fabio Jakobsen are there as well. Who else is there?
Olav Koy.
He's done an altitude camp. Olav Koy on Grand Tour debut. And you've got Fernando Gaviria, but who hasn't won a Grand Tour stage for five long years now.
As a Dane,
As a Dane?
That's not what I mean when I'm saying Dane. Didn't you lot watch the Tour of Turkey?
Lund.
Well, yes, Tobias Lund. However, Tobias Lund is in the same team as Fabio Jakobsen, isn't he?
Yeah, so he was as well at the Tour of Turkey, and Jakobsen was nowhere near anything. I mean, he won when he was trying to lead out Jakobsen. Just saying.
Let's see that sorted out on the road. I wouldn't want to make that decision for them on their sports directors, but they've been in this position before. That I'm glad you made the point, because DSM were in this position, weren't they, with Dainese and another?
Yeah, Dainese is also riding. He still lays claim to the unique distinction of having won only Grand Tour stages with zero classified climbs. And there is a day in this Giro d'Italia which doesn't have a classified climb, so look out for him. I think it might be the stage to, is it Cento? Rob?
Yeah, that's the flattest Grand Tour stage you can get. 150 metres climbing in the whole day on the Emiliano Romagnolo plane. Let me just finish the list because some fans are going to get angry. Molano's there for UAE, although he might not have too much freedom. And let's not forget about Phil Bauhaus either, because of course he's been winning this year for Bahrain Victorious. And as well, if we mention Dainese, we've got to mention Meyerhofer as well, because he is a sprinter who can climb. He's been at altitude. And they'll both be helped by Matteo Trentin. So I can see Tudor Pro Cycling winning at least one stage at this Giro.
Chaps, and this list, or the list that you've just given us, Rob, it worries me slightly. I have a slight concern that the sprints in this Giro d'Italia are going to be extremely chaotic because you've got a lot of...
They always are, aren't they?
Well, they always are. You've got a lot of top-level sprints, more than ever, I would say. I mean, that is a stellar sprinting field. And that said, you haven't necessarily got the most experienced lead out trains with them in some cases, and that concerns me slightly. We have seen some dangerous finishes in the Giro d'Italia before. I don't know the race settling early, if Pogacar does take the pink jersey on the first or the second day, whether that might help matters slightly, sort of settle the GC guys to a certain extent, and they might take more of a back seat. But can you sort of see where what I'm getting at here?
Yes, that things can happen in the run-up into sprints and you never know what might happen, as in who might be affected.
Also, a lot of days, and this is one of my big bugbears with this route, there aren't too many, particularly in the first 2 weeks, there aren't that many days over which, in my head, there is a question mark. It's very clear that certain days are going to be a sprint or not a sprint. And we see very often that those are the most dangerous days, because you get this kind of anticipation, this stress that mounts in the bunch. You know, the director sportifs are feeding information to their riders throughout the stage almost, and filling people's heads with what they have to do in the last few kilometers. And then we see chaos unleashed as they come into the last 10 kilometers. But just, you know, just going back to that point about the route, it kind of grieves me to see a Giro route like this, when you have, the topography of Italy, the Apennines, you have the and towns built on the top of hills. I've said this before on the podcast. There is great scope to just build something beautiful and incredible and uncertain. To leave a question mark over almost every day. And this is what I think the Vuelta's done really well over the last 10 years or so. And the Tour de France is doing it as well now. If you look at the start, the first few stages of the Tour de France, the Italian stages, you know, there are all sorts of scenarios we could see there. And in this Giro route, it's pretty clear in my head what we're going to see on most days, what type of stage and what type of finish we're going to see.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the virtual private network to keep your data safe and secure, whether you're at home, on the move, or away on holiday, or perhaps on a work trip. Daniel will be off to Italy at the end of the week, and I'm sure when he checks into a hotel, he will ask at the reception what the Wi-Fi code is so he can get online. And that's something we often do, isn't it? When we're on holiday or on a work trip and we check into the hotel, we want to get connected, or maybe you connect up using the tethering function on your mobile phone. But how often do you think about how secure those connections are? Way back, it wasn't something that I particularly gave a lot of thought to. I just trusted that those connections would be secure. And perhaps I was a little bit naive in that assumption. Certainly for many years now, I've been using NordVPN to make sure that when I'm online, whether I'm at home or on the move, my connections are not going to be hijacked by anyone who's trying to pinch the data. Well, NordVPN can give you complete security. It can protect your data, whether you are using your computer at home or your smart TV or your mobile phone or tablet. NordVPN works across a range of devices. And well, I wouldn't want to advertise this too much, but Arsenal, Daniel's football team, are in the hunt for the Premier League title. And I wonder whether he will use a NordVPN in order to watch the matches. I couldn't possibly comment. Anyway, if you would like to give NordVPN a whirl, you can do so by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. You'll get a great deal, and there's a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee as well. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP. We'll put those details in the show notes.
Well, chaps, we did a fairly good job in that second part of not talking too much about the great unmentionable, the sort of the ogre-like figure towering, looming over this Giro d'Italia, dominating all of the talk before the race, talk of his hopes to become the first man since Marco Pantani in 1998 to do the Giro Tour double. Of course, I'm talking about Tadej Pogacar. Marco Pantani's 1998 Giro Tour double is subject of another one of our Giro Vagando Kilometer Zeros coming out this week. Brian, that was you and I talking about the Giro that really, that sort of confirmed or consolidated our love of the Giro d'Italia, or sparked our love of the Giro d'Italia. We were certainly gripped by that race, and that podcast talks a lot about that edition of the Giro. Chaps, the double, the Giro Tour double, it's become one of sports, sort of, the sport of cycling's new taboos, because it wasn't always a taboo. It was used to be quite common. It was common in the 90s. It was accomplished three times in the 90s. Indurain did it twice. Pantani did it as well, as we've said, in 1998. And it was something that people didn't really consider as that unusual. It was sort of, on the contrary, seen as not a formality, but something that was kind of natural for the best stage race rider of the day, the best 3-week stage race rider of the day, to both attempt and pull off. Can he do it? Is he going to do it? Is it wise to even attempt it? Let's have a quick fire on that now, and then we will hear a bit more about how he intends to do it in just a second.
Yes and yes.
Very quick one, Rob. Brian?
Yes and yes for me as well, but parts of it is not, it's beyond his control. I think it depends more on Vingegaard being ready for the tour than it does for Pogacar being able to pull off 2 Grand Tour races in a row.
Very brief, very succinct, very concise. Well done, chaps. I said we'd find out more about how he intends to do it. I also mentioned that Giro Vagando Kilometer Zero coming out this week. Love and Other Drugs about the 98 Giro in particular. We have got another one coming out this week called Alpha. No, what's it called? Sierra Alpha. Not Alpha Sierra. Sierra Alpha. And that is about Pogacar's...
an episode of The Bill.
Well, that was the intention. That is a deep dive, a sort of peek behind the scenes of Tadej Pogacar's preparations for this Giro d'Italia. He spent most of the month of April at altitude in southern Spain, in the Sierra Nevada. And our man on the ground down there in Andalusia, Fran Reyes, donned his deerstalker, and he made a couple of trips to the Sierra Nevada, where the UAE team, their Giro team, was sort of holed up. Pogacar was holed up. And he conducted some very interesting interviews up there at UAE's April billet. One of them was with UAE's performance coordinator, Jeroen Swart. Another one was with Rafał Majka, who's going to be one of Pogacar's key domestiques at the Giro d'Italia. Let's hear now from Jeroen and from Rafał Majka about Pogacar and his Giro bid.
2022 for us was difficult because prior to the start of the tour and in the first week of the tour and even throughout the tour, our team was, by before the tour, COVID. We had a number of substitutions. The substituted riders developed COVID. And we had to remove the substituted rider and resubstitute the riders that previously were withdrawn, in the case of Mark Hirschi, for instance. Then the tour started. We had a number of riders who then developed COVID during the race. Mark Soler developed gastroenteritis and withdrew. And so for that reason, we ended up with a team that was at a far lower level than, you know, that we had on paper. 3 weeks before the tour, we had a team that on paper was as strong as Jumbo-Visma, if not stronger. But by the time we got to the second week of the tour, we were a team on the back foot. And on the Col de Grana, as you saw in the race, Tadej became isolated. We didn't know at the time that Primoz had his back injury and that he would not be able to perform at that level. So as a team, we had to follow both him and Jonas and assume that either of them could win the GC, and Tadej had to follow each of their attacks. And that in cycling is a recipe for success if you're the team with more numbers. And we see it in all the races, and it's exactly what happened. Tadej missed a bottle, a key feed. He didn't have the exogenous carbohydrates that we were talking about. And so on the final climb, he became carbohydrate depleted, and he didn't have the energy reserves to be able to follow Jonas. Last year was a different story. As you know, he crashed in Liège-Bastogne-Liège and injured his wrist. Knowing his capacity to assimilate training, we believed that he would be able to make up for that in the time that was still remaining. But it wasn't enough. He didn't have enough time to prepare to be at the level he needed to be to match Jonas on the big climbs. And in the beginning, the first week, which were more explosive stages, Tadej was more dominant. But as that slight energy deficit because of the not entirely optimal physiology, because of the shortened preparation period, results in that just on a daily basis, that cumulative fatigue.
Snowball effect.
And by the time we got to the third week, it was not enough to win the tour. Had he had, if Jonas wasn't there, Tadej would have won the tour because it would have been a much easier race for him. He would have not had to exert himself to the extent that he would have, which means less energy deficit, which means a better recovery and probably a lack of this failure in the third week. He's also adapted his training. Tade has a new coach, Javier Sola, which you may know. And Javier is a fantastic coach who has made some very important changes to his preparation. And we see already the results of that. The numbers don't lie. He's doing the best numbers of his career. He's producing power outputs. And one of the key factors that has become part of research in cycling in the last 5 years is durability. One of my PhD students, James Sprague, who's now a tutor, he did his entire PhD in durability. Mm-hmm. And durability is one of the most important ways that we measure performance, because many riders, particularly junior riders and under 23 riders, can do a very high VO2 max effort, a 5-minute effort with very high power outputs, 8 watts per kilo sometimes. But they cannot do that after 5 hours of racing, after they've used already 4,000 or 4,500 kilojoules of energy. And in those times when Tade is now beyond having used 4,000 kilojoules, his performances this year are a standout compared to all his previous years. He's able to produce very high power outputs in the final hour of races, much more than he's ever done in the past. And that is as a result of those changes in his training that have now unlocked further mechanisms that have actually made him the strongest Tade that we've ever seen. And we see it in the races. We saw it at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. We saw it at Strade Bianche. He has the confidence to know that he can attack with 50, 60, 70 kilometers to go and be able to still produce the power outputs required to stay away and win the race. And so we will go into the Giro d'Italia with that confidence, and hopefully it's enough to potentially do the Giro Tour double. We will see.
And is it too much to be of an asking to know what those changes in today's training mean?
Yeah, I mean, one of them is the incorporation of more strength work. So the ability to produce torque. So torque is one of the two components of power. Force and velocity, and improving his ability to produce force or torque has been one of the factors that has enhanced his performance. The other one is the mechanisms that we spoke about, the fact that you can stimulate more adaptation by incorporating more high-intensity training. So he's done more high-intensity interval training than before, and that has also resulted in more adaptation of the enhancements that result in improved endurance and durability. And those are, we know that interval training paradoxically increases your glycogen stores in your muscles, increases capillarization of muscle, increases mitochondrial mass, increases lactate buffering, increases lactate redistribution, efflux and redistribution. So all of those mechanisms have been hyperstimulated by more high intensity training, together with strength training, together with the other methods that he was already using. And so together, those are some of the key factors that have changed how he has approached his training.
But this machine, I want to say this machine, he came training
really crazy because he's really professional guy. Well, I want to say it's like with the food and with the exercise when we do it before the training, also in the training. You don't imagine how the block he do it, the training is like here, especially now. Now, I tell you, when I have problem with my Achilles, I'm suffering training with him. Well, he's really strong and
he's ready. He's ready already for the next race.
Yeah, because I'm wondering, you know, I know that normally whenever the trainer set up the training for you, it is kind of individual. You know, you can do more or less, you get your efforts adapted to your level and such. Yet, I guess that even in that circumstances, training with such a talent squeezes you out.
Yeah, that's why you need to be careful, because I remember my friend's first training camp in Tata. They squeezed me a lot, and that's why I'm learning this machine. And better to give him a little bit more space.
It's the fact that the Giro this year is, so to say, less spontaneous than the previous editions, that it is a bit less tough, does it help his chances of winning, of making the GT double?
No, because, you know, when you think about this, it's like Giro is so hard because it's so many climbs. Mm-hmm. Depends how you finish also the Giro, because when we do it so many climbs, like 4,000 or 5,000 meters, and in the end, you're suffering only the meters level, you know, like every day you're pushing, you need to be fresh in the end, you know, also Tadej need to recover after then. But for my opinion, this shape when he has now, he can start now the Giro, because then it's really good. It's really have good legs, and especially when people don't see him, you know, like, yeah, he come in the race, but this guy is really training. He's really training, hard training, and he did everything to be the best. I hope so he can win the Giro and Tour.
Chaps, first thing I wanted to ask you about before we move on, we sort of glossed over, we mentioned Molano at UAE and the fact that they are taking Molano. There have been murmurs on social media about the UAE team not being that strong in the mountains. The fact that they are taking Molano, what do you make of that?
They've got to give everybody an opportunity to keep everybody happy, haven't they? And that's becoming an increasingly more difficult job. If they want this team of superstars to back up their leader, who, when Tadej Pogacar or whoever it might be, you know, maybe some of the young guns in the next year or so say, well, today's my day, I want to win. Mm. They all have to be for them. They have to have had their opportunities. So we've seen Adam Yates getting his opportunities. We've seen those young guns getting their opportunities. They're starting to turn up to races that maybe they didn't turn up to all often in the past. I certainly didn't expect to see them on the plane the other day to Asturias, when they're on their way over here as well. But, you know, it gives an opportunity for someone like Micah to get a few kilometres in, to be a bit more of a protagonist, to help out both Morgado and Del Toro, Finn Fisher Black as well. So all these guys waiting in the wings. And the same goes for a top sprinter too. You know, if they want to, if they're ever having a bit of a dry period, a drought in the GC, well, they want their guy to pick up wins, don't they? And it's part of their identity. They've become this team that wins the most races throughout the year now and gets that UCI number one spot. And I think it's all part of that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Pogacar approaches those finales on the sprint days. Whether we've seen GC riders in the past with sprinters in their teams try to kind of use the sprint train and try to latch onto the end, onto the back of that, and to stay safe that way. That might be a better solution than, well, when we have in the past seen a GC rider to whom the whole team is devoted and building the whole train around taking him to 3 kilometers to go mark and kind of stressing him out. That has in the past not worked particularly well. Pogacar, to be honest, he's not the kind of rider who's ever seemed to struggle with that aspect of Grand Tour racing. He handles his bike well. He's also very relaxed, isn't he? And that is gives him a bit of a force field. I sort of touch wood when I say that. I don't want to tempt fate. But it certainly helps him to negotiate those finishes pretty safely on the whole. But that was really interesting from Jeroen Swart, and really interesting, a lot of what Fran was able to collect on the Sierra Nevada. By all accounts, the preparation seems to have gone incredibly well. And not just on the Sierra Nevada, but this year in general. Jeroen there mentioned, well, the learnings that they have taken from the last couple of years, the Tour de France, and he also mentioned Pogacar's new coach this year, things that they have changed. And also just this issue of economy, and this is going to be key in the Giro. How does Pogacar make sure that he's not going quite as far into the red as other riders at the Giro, and thinking as well about the Tour de France and thinking about recovering in time for the Tour de France, because the team is making no bones about it. They're not being cagey or circumspect in any way. They are saying loud and proud, we are going for this double.
I think being as strong as he is, and then as you talk about economizing how he wants to win the Giro, the Giro will never be a preparation for the Tour. It's just a question of balancing those two against each other. I think before they, well, that's my guess anyways, before they go and start those really hard three stages in the Dolomites, I think Pogacar will have secured his victory. And a lot of that has to do, in my opinion, with the time trial. He can even, you know, he can ride, which is almost impossible to imagine, relatively conservative in the first hard stages. I don't think he will, but he could. And he could even win without spending that much energy. But he can ultimately, I think, secure any kind of victory he wants with any kind of margin already on the time trial. And that means he doesn't have to go that deep in those Dolomite stages. Even still, if he wasn't to do the Giro, he would still be training hard at altitude, maybe accumulating some of the same type of fatigue at that time of May in preparation for the Tour. So I think being as strong as he is, he can economize a lot easier than anyone else in preparation for the Tour.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of principle that they are putting their faith in, that Pogacar doesn't go as deep as everyone else. And therefore, obviously, logically, he recovers better because he's not absolutely ripping his legs off every day. But it's a really interesting question, this, isn't it, about the economy and the strategizing, the strategy of their race. Because I don't know about you, chaps. I mean, this is my unique brand of fag packet physiology, but and knowing absolutely, you know, almost nothing about the subject. But if I was them and if I was him, I think that it would be prudent to start hard and to extinguish all other hopes on those first couple of days. And I think then the race will sort of settle. Any resignation that we talked about a minute ago that is already present among those pretenders, that will only solidify, and they will almost forget about Pogacar and forget about trying to beat him. What he doesn't want is people sort of smelling blood and sort of sensing that there's an opportunity for them. But I think in those first two stages, I think he can take the pink jersey on day one, and I think he can take a minute on day two. It's not necessarily the stage that suits him best, the stage to Europa, but he's so superior that I think he can take, with the time bonuses as well, a minute. If he's got a minute 20 after 2 days, then I think, Brian, he can, you know, almost from a nervous system point of view as well, I think they can all kind of relax and breathe. And I think that will be hugely important in the economy of what they want to do later in the summer.
I think at any given point over the next 2 months, you'll have to consider, where is Vingegaard, what is he doing, and how ready will he potentially be as a competitor to Tadej Pogacar. And I think looking at, and this is coming back to what Swart so brilliantly explained from the last two Tour de Frances, when you look at the, and this is not to talk about the Tour, but when you look at how hard the Tour start is this year, say that Vingegaard comes into the Tour a little bit undercooked, a little bit not as ready as he wanted to be. Those two first stages of the Tour are extremely hard. And Tadej Pogacar will want to be able to put him under a world of pressure that early. So I think they're looking at the Tour and the Giro as two connected blocks of performance. And they're looking at how do we balance the effort that Pogacar will make during the Giro to be as ready as he wants to be to take on Vingegaard. And Vingegaard's current state is an enigma. You know, he hasn't done any interviews. We don't know if he's on the bike. We don't know. Well, they've already said he's not going to be able to go to altitude this early as or however they were planning it. So I think any kind of balance in the expenditure of how Pogacar strategizes his performance will have to be parallel with where Vingegaard is, and he's nowhere to be seen. So I think there's not a lot of worry in Pogacar's mind at current, because Vingegaard might not even be at the Tour. And if he's not at the Tour, and 90% Pogacar is still the biggest favorite you could imagine.
I think we can get ahead of ourselves a little here. I'm going to be the boring one for now, because I know that people be throwing stuff at their phones, at their speakers, whatever, saying, hang on a minute. First, he's got to win the Giro. Then we don't know, like you say, if Jonas is going to be there. What about Primoz Roglic? What about Remco Evenepoel? There's a lot that can change. One thing about the Giro, though, I completely agree that I think he'd like to get it done and dusted, thinking about the Tour early doors, and those two opening stages certainly provide the opportunity for
doing that. Like I said before, win before the super volcano.
Well, there's that. There's that. He's got to be in pink as early as he can, just in case the race gets stopped. But going ahead, you know, we know that Pogacar being the rider he is.
You love. You'll be sitting in a bloody studio. Brian and I will be in the front line. We'll be dodging.
Oh, hang on a minute. If the rocks reach Greenland last time, London will be it. Don't you worry.
We'll be dodging lava bombs. You'll be in a Costa coffee. You know, sipping.
We're doing a little bit better than that.
Sipping your oversized mochaccino.
You know I don't have milk with my coffee.
Go on. Anyway,
I'm an espresso man. It's an espresso first weekend, isn't it? So let's return to that. It's an espresso first weekend. We think that Pogacar is going to be the one trying to get the coffees in, don't we, on those first couple of days. He likes records. He's already taken quite a few of those, hasn't he? The whole peloton's been taking records from the start of this year. And the peloton took a record from Gianni Bugno at the start of this year, didn't he? And is he about to lose another one? Because he lost his fastest San Remo to Jasper Philipps earlier this year. We've already seen the fastest, I can't remember how many spring classics there were this year that had that title. I'm not talking maybe about the fastest Giro, but I'm talking about holding the jersey from start to finish. Only two riders have ever done that. Eddy Merckx, of course, and then Gianni Bugno was the last one. Tadej Pogacar, gents, will he take it from start to finish? Does he want to take it from start to finish, given his team? Can he get the advantage on his GC guys and then, you know, let a big breakaway go and they can have it for a few sort of days, people who aren't necessarily a factor? How do you think he's going to go about it?
You mentioned Bugno.
I think he wants to start to finish. I think definitely start to finish, in my opinion.
And you think that'd be a good thing, Brian? I was just going to mention as well, Bugno, one of the reasons he was able to do that, take the pink jersey early and keep it, was that there was a mountain stage in the first week of that Giro up Vesuvius. The side of Vesuvius, which might be slightly ominous for us.
Let's hope that Tadej doesn't really want to connect all the omens and take the records this year, Daniel.
Brian, is that? I mean, there are two different things, aren't there? There's been the virtual leader of the race, the sort of leader of the race that everyone acknowledges and recognises, but in theory, but not in name. And then there's actually having the pink jersey. Having the pink jersey, there are all sorts of considerations there. There are all sorts of reasons why riders don't like to do it, or riders who intend to win a Grand Tour. One of the key ones being the protocol and the faff and the palaver after stages. And I think, look, if they could design the next 3 weeks, UAE would say that they prefer not to have the pink jersey throughout.
Yeah, but with the start of the Giro as it is, I don't think they can. And second of all, it doesn't seem to take much out of Pogacar to do those protocol interviews, podium, etc., etc. And I think that weighs in as well. And I think he wants the jersey start to finish. And when you look at modern racing, at least how Jumbo-Visma wants to do it and UAE wants to do it, they want control and they want it early and they want to distribute the expenditure of energy over those 3 weeks. And I think they would prefer that, taking the risk of, you know, jeopardizing certain elements of the recuperation of Tadej Pogacar. I think that weighs way above the everything that else would be risky if they gave it away, and who knows what can happen. I think they want to keep
Brian, you say he doesn't seem to mind all the faff and the ceremony and the palaver, post-stage palaver. Might be different at the Giro. You well know, we know the Italian media. When after his, you know, 10,000th question about, ti piace l'Italia? Do you like Italy? What's your favorite? What's your favorite
Italian
pizza
song?
Topic? Yeah. Have you ever been to Sorrento?
Yeah.
I mean, you might think differently.
There'll be some interview fatigue.
3 hours after every
very
stage.
Early on.
Yeah, exactly.
Very early on.
There's just one more point to make on that. I'm looking down the list of stages, and if Pogacar does turn up and have this mega first weekend, two wins out of two stages, on the attack as he does, doing his crazy things, it might not just be the pink jersey he has to worry about missing. It might be getting rid of the mountains jersey and, of course, the Maglia Ciclamino for a few days that might be difficult as well.
What?
Well, I think, regardless, if you look specifically at the parcours, he will need to take it no later than the Perugia time trial.
Sorry.
Right? I mean, after the Perugia time trial, it has to be in his possession for the rest of the race, in my opinion.
Sorry, Rob, I see what you mean now. In terms of protocol.
Yeah, I don't mean taking that start to finish. I mean getting rid of it for a few days because he's going to be racking up mounting points if he goes on these sort of...
You mean from the point of view of the protocol, of not having to do the protocol?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Because obviously you can get rid of pink jersey, but if you've been the one who's won on Europa, which is I think Montagna Pantani this year, so there's going to be sort of extra.
See, what we're saying
there is
he wants to avoid prizes. Don't win any prize. Like if anyone offers him a salame, you know, they used to have these salami that they could win at the sort of intermediate sprints.
Get an extra truck to tour around all his trophies.
He'll be avoiding podiums.
But it's just collateral.
He'll be avoiding podiums like we'll be avoiding super volcanoes, hopefully. That is true, though, that he has become, more than any rider, I think, in the history of professional cycling, he has become so practiced in this because every single race that he did in stage race, he had the white jersey for approximately 5 years. So he knows the drill, shall we say.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views and interviews from the world of professional cycling.
Hello, Lionel again for the final time this episode, I assure you, to say a big thank you to our clothing partner, MAP. Now, we'll be hearing a lot more about MAP and the latest that they've been up to during the Giro d'Italia. I know that they've got several new ranges on their website, which I recommend you have a look at. It's map.cc, that's MAAP.cc. Now, last week, I did a four-day charity bike ride to raise money for a charity that supported my mum when she was going through chemotherapy. And as this ride was taking place in southern England in April, I knew I had to be prepared for all weathers, but I was also travelling light. And that's where the MAP clothing really comes into its own. I could go off with four or five items and I knew that it would be good come rain or shine. And I had a bit of everything. I had rain and hail. I had bright sunshine, I had wind, and the MAP clothing, as well as fitting perfectly, kept me snug and dry and warm. And, well, fortunately, I was wearing my casque helmet that I bought. And recently, MAP have formed a collaboration with casque helmet. So I felt like I was fully branded up in MAP and casque clothing and looking good on the bike, even if I wasn't traveling especially quickly. I looked the part. And that basically is the most important thing, isn't it? Anyway, we will hear a lot more about MAP over the course of the Giro, but have a look at the website map.cc. And if I may just mention one other thing, sign up for the 1101 Cappuccino, the regular email from the Cycling Podcast. You can sign up for it at thecyclingpodcast.com and then it will plop into your inbox without you having to do anything else. And it will keep you up to date throughout the Giro. Now back to Daniel for the final part.
Another consideration, and to be honest, I haven't really paid that much attention to this year, is transfers. In the past, they have been a big topic of conversation at the Giro d'Italia. How much traveling do teams, riders, journalists have to do between stages? And that can be onerous as well. I'm not sure this year looks too bad. We're not covering that much distance. Another bugbear that I have with this year's Giro d'Italia, I'm not the biggest necessarily fan of the south of Italy or parts of the south of Italy. However, what I do appreciate about the Giro and, well, the opportunity it gives us to go to the south of Italy is it takes us to places that I don't necessarily know that much. There aren't that many sort of standout days on this Giro where I think it's taking me somewhere that we are not familiar with from the Giri of the last 10 years or even the Tirreno Adriatico, you know, you've got Prati di Tivo, that kind of thing. There aren't that many sort of big showpieces. Also culturally as well, we've got Superga, Torino in the first weekend. But in terms of a narrative, and, you know, as we do every year, I had my pre-race briefing with John Foote, our sort of cultural commentator, modern historical commentator. We'll be hearing from him throughout the Giro d'Italia. And we picked out lots of interesting things, anniversaries and that kind of thing to talk about. And you'll hear those during our Giro coverage. But we had to think a little bit more creatively than we often do this year, I shall say.
So this is...
You're
talking about the first week. I mean, Pompeii. And I'm not talking about the first week, but in general, I mean, Pompeii, you know, we're not going to Rome, but we're going to Lucca as well.
Puccini.
City. Yeah. But I just think, you know, Perugia, Naples, Pompeii. I mean, those are all significant names for any kind of cultural heritage.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose. Okay. All right. All right.
For me, it seems to be... I get what you mean about the sort of set pieces, Daniel. And I think you and I had this conversation, you know, we generally converse as soon as the route comes out, doesn't it, on a Giro. And I think we were both disappointed that there wasn't this big sort of, famous... I know we've got Europa early on,
Apple, no
but not
climb,
big mountain stages. No, there's no big finish.
No.
Classic finish.
No.
There's no Wembley or Camp Nou, is there?
No, and in fact, for many years... You know, during the Zomignan era, for example, when the Giro was really sort of leaning into this identity of being the hardest race, they held the sort of mantle that has been taken on by the Vuelta a España, where the pre-race hype about the route, and in particular climbs, extreme climbs, was a big part of the mood music going into the race. And we haven't seen that for a while. I mean, what was the last... I suppose we had Monte Lussari last year, but in terms of show-stopping climbs that the Giro has discovered, unveiled, revealed, presented, it's been a while, and there isn't one. There certainly isn't one on this year's route. We've got on the stage, I think it's the stage of Sapada, the Passo Duron, which is very hard. But that is certainly, you know, it's not top line in terms of, you know, how the race is being talked about and hyped up, either in Italy or abroad. But culturally, chaps, or just in terms of the geography, as we sort of wind up now, anything in particular that you are looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to stage 16, actually. And contrary to you, Daniel, I am a fan of southern Italy, but I'm going up north.
I mean, I'm a fan. It's all relative. I just, the north is where I feel more at home, shall we say, to rephrase it slightly. And to, you know.
Well, you know, I'm more of a Mediterranean man. But further north, you're from Blackburn, the mountains,
mate.
In your terrain.
You're from Blackburn.
Accrington. if you look...
Not Blackburn.
Further Lancash, north,
the,
so you're...
The Lancashire Riviera, go on.
Oh, yeah, that's Blackpool. Dear me. Don't go in that sea, your legs will dissolve. Look into your terrain, Daniel, because it is your terrain because this is German-speaking Italy. One place that I remember going on holiday to when, I think in my early 20s sometime, was not far from Bolzano. The stage is going to go all the way up past a place called Fia lo Sciliar and Siusia lo Sciliar, which I think are Falls and Seis in German. And there's going to be the Intergiro there. And we're going to see an intermediate sprint on the way up Passo Pinay. And then it finishes up at in Val Gardena. And that's a really stunning area of Italy. Siusi, we've had time trials up there, I think.
You mean Falkenstein in Gröden?
There we go. That's better. That's the start. Selva, Wolkenstein is the place to start on the next day. I think they're finishing Santa Cristina the night before, up Montepana. But that's a beautiful area of Italy. It's very different culturally. The language obviously changes. Even speaking Italian, the accent changes because it's not a mother tongue particularly. But it's a completely different area of Italy. And for anyone looking for a different experience of Italy with the scenery and culture, it's a real surprise and a pleasant one at that, isn't it?
Indeed. Brian?
Well, it would be too easy if I said that because the Giro is coming home in the sense that there are stages in Tuscany and a race actually passes Pietrasanta where I'm sitting now. For me, it's definitely visiting Napoli again. It's just everything is just chaotic in a different way. It's a very unique place in Italy. Something always happens. You know, fingers crossed, there's not going to be an earthquake. And I've just recently been writing a piece about Paolo Sorrentino. You know, my favorite Italian film director. And I think the whole atmosphere and everything that surrounds you when you are in Naples, you sort of get immersed into a different culture, an Italian culture that's certainly very different to the one I'm used to in my everyday life. So it would be a very difficult place for me to live, and I'm quite certain that will never happen. But it's an amazing place to visit for a couple of days, adding the spectacle of the Giro. And then obviously the day after the stage after starting in Pompeii, which I've only visited very briefly. You know, I've also enjoyed the parts that where you visited with Lionel. I look forward to seeing the huge Igor Mitorai sculptures there. So that's my looking at it now, the highlight of this Giro in terms of culture.
I am looking forward, Brian, if we get the opportunity, if we haven't been incinerated by that point, I look forward to going to the Amalfi Coast on the rest day. I've never been to the Amalfi Coast, and we are staying adjacent to it on that first rest day after the stage to Napoli before.
Positano?
No, never been. So I'm looking forward to that. Ciro has promised to give me a bit of a tour. I don't think that's going to materialize, because Ciro is an elusive character at the best of times, and on the rest day of the Giro d'Italia he's not going to devote 3 hours to giving me a tour of the Amalfi. Ciro of course will be dropping in to our daily podcast when he gets the opportunity. We're also this year going to have a lot more input from our very good friends at Bidon and Al Vento, Leonardo Piccione, Filippo Cauz, Michele Pelacci. There's also a new addition to that team this year, Marta, who she's going to be joining us. Marta, I think, has been given a special mission. She's on Pog Watch. She'll be unveiling, revealing all sorts of new information about Tadej Pogacar throughout the course of the Giro, and hopefully she'll be sharing some of that with us as well. Chaps, highlights for me, I'm sort of almost loath to say this, because when the RCS announced that there would be a stage to Europa, I sort of grimaced a little bit, because we've had endless Pantani sort of tributes over the last 10 years or so. And we've talked a lot on the podcast about Italian cycling's sort of trauma, the Pantani trauma, and this inability to kind of redefine themselves and redefine the sport in Italy and look beyond Pantani, move beyond Pantani. And Europa, well, it's the 25th anniversary of Pantani's famous win at Europa, and there is a stage going up there on the second day, and it will be exciting. I can remember, chaps, I don't know if you remember watching that stage, but it's funny, you know, I wasn't a Pantani fan particularly, and I remember that day, and the story, the sort of myth of that stage is built around the fact that his chain slipped at the bottom of the climb and he lost a lot of ground. I don't know where he was in the peloton. He was maybe 40, 50 positions back, and he rode through the field. I don't know, like a pizza knife through a margherita. Well, that's probably a really terrible... it's not very...
That's what kind of pizza it is, doesn't it?
Yeah, really? Exactly. So much so that, you know, a lot of the riders he was passing, he didn't know where he was in the race, and they didn't really know either, and he didn't celebrate when he came over the finish line because he thought that, well, he wasn't sure that he'd caught everyone. But I remember feeling very queasy that day about what we'd just seen, and finding it slightly grotesque, shall I say. And what I also found slightly grotesque was the outpouring, the hysteria that followed that performance. And then, of course, a few days later, he failed the blood test and was kicked out of the race at Madonna Campiglio. But I wrote a piece a few years ago about that stage, and just sort of revisited some of the hyperbole that followed that performance. I've got a couple of things here that I'll just read out. Candido Canavò, the famous longtime editor of the Gazzetta dello Sport, he said, "Old reporters, men who have witnessed half a century of races, swear that in 8 kilometres Pantani climb, not just a mountain, but the imaginary league table of modern cycling epics. The people of cycling will talk about it for years. The ones who trudged up the slope will say with solemn pride, I was there." Marco Pastonesi wrote, "Pantani's every acceleration is a heart flutter, an image that absolutely everyone has stored in some cell of their brain. Pantani's every acceleration is a little treasure which no one needs to keep secret. It's money in the bank. It's in the bank of our senses and our memory. Free money. It costs nothing. Just a few moments to turn on the TV and open your eyes." And there was me sitting at home thinking, not sure about this, chaps.
That's the difference, Daniel. I always say that
during the Giro of any Grand Tour is that he's more of a glass half full kind of guy. But here we're talking about a paper cup with a hole in it, aren't we, Daniel?
Well, I was right. I was right.
You were right. You were right. But in defense of those who had to write the words, Daniel, this is entertainment and you have to say what you see. You can't start throwing aspersions around when you're writing articles or talking about things live.
I don't know, Rob.
Without anything there.
No, well, without anything there, that's an important point. But at that time, you have to consider the context of that time. That was less than a year after the Festina scandal. And there were already murmurs. I mean, Brian and I cover them. We touch on them in our podcast about the 1998 Giro. There was an atmosphere and there were rumors even about what happened in that 1998 Giro that were in the public domain. Then in that 99 Giro, there was a very sort of high profile dispute between Pantani and the Mappe riders. Andrea Tafi was reduced to tears in one stage. This argument over the blood tests that the Italian Federation was carrying out. Pantani said that they were kind of a violation and invasion of the rider's privacy. And already that was a couple of days before Europa. And that in particular, for me, left a very sort of sour taste. So I kind of watched, you know, and think about what we've just heard from Candido Cannavò and Marco Pastanesi. They knew that they were privy to what had been going on, this argument that he had with Taffy and the fact that Pantani didn't want his blood tested. And that rang ill. All sorts of alarm bells, or should have, and yet any kind of disbelief was certainly suspended by a lot of the Italian journalists watching. Anyway, chaps, enough about that. I think, I'm excited. I'm excited. Can't wait to get there. Excited about the journey we're going to go on with the listeners. We already heard our famous, our now iconic theme tune at the start of this episode, Cozze by Amara Terra. They will be supplying our music, as always, during the Giro d'Italia. You can buy their music, listen to their music at amaraterra.bandcamp.com. What else have we got before we go, chaps? Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention. Turin, to get you in the mood for the Grande Partenza in Torino at the weekend, talks about our kilometer zero. I also wanted to alert you to, there's a very good Netflix documentary, The King Who Never Was. So earlier this year, the son of the last king of Italy, Vittorio Emanuele di Savoia, he died on the 4th of February, in fact. And that documentary, The King Who Never Was, is a documentary about the Savoy dynasty family. And his is an extraordinary story. I mean, he was tried for murder, an incident that occurred in France, in Corsica, well, just off Corsica, 1978, he was alleged to have shot a German sort of friend or tourist dead. And this case sort of rumbled on for years and years, was a subject of a lot of kind of debate and speculation in Italy. A remarkable tale that's well recounted in that documentary, The King Who Never Was, on Netflix. The Savoy family, of course, and he was allowed, after over 50 years of exile, was finally allowed to come back to Italy in 2002. Brian, well, you're already in Italy. I will be allowed to come back to Italy at the weekend. Giro Vagando, Giro d'Italia. It starts this week. We've got all sorts going on, but our daily episodes start on Saturday. Be sure to tune into Eurosport to hear Rob do his thing.
Eurosport and Discovery Plus in Europe. And for those of you listening in the US, we are streaming live on Max as well. Every stage live, start to finish, Daniel.
Wonderful. Chaps, it's been a delight. It's been a pleasure. Brian, I'll see you on Friday.
A presto.
Grazie.